Disclaimer. The views and opinions expressed by the participants in this show are not the views of AnimeNewsNetwork.com. Enjoy the show. In our first segment here, we've got returning guest and friend of the show, representative from the AM Squared convention, which is July 1st through the 3rd in Anaheim, California, Chase Wang. Hey, Chase.
Hey, thanks, Zach. I really appreciate the opportunity today.
Sure. So we talked to you about your event a couple of months ago. I think it was last winter. And, you know, back then things hadn't completely firmed up, but we're about a week out, so I can't even imagine how busy you must be.
Yeah, we're actually getting pretty crazy. We're getting a lot of positive responses from fans as well as industry representatives who are supporting us. Lots of support from Japan, so we're very, very excited. We have, since the last time we spoke, increased our guests of honors into a huge, massive group of guests of honors that are coming. Some from Madhouse, which is this huge, for those who don't know, a huge animation studio in Japan. And we're premiering a lot of different films and having a lot of different activities for our fans and attendees.
So the big thing is that this convention is free, but you guys are pushing real hard on these passports, like very aggressive, trying to get people to buy these passports. Now that you've got everything firmed up, what does the passport get you and how much is it?
At the moment is $45 a piece, which is a great deal for all 3 days. And we also have 2 days as well as 1 day pricing as well. And the passport is pretty much your convention fast pass. And the reason I can say honestly that we're pushing people to go get into this is not only because it's a great deal and you get all these amazing discounts like 40% off of Disneyland and discounts at Medieval Times as well as Best Buy and all that. It's more of the fact that we want our attendees and fans to know that, you know, even though we would love to accommodate, you know, 10,000 people to every single room, we obviously cannot. We're limited by what we can obtain from the Anaheim Convention Center. So in order to give as many people the opportunity to participate in certain events such as our Bunraku premiere or the screenings of Mai Mai Miracle as well as Yona Yona Penguin and a few other events that are passport-specific events or even our general events, is that they have a better chance of getting a seat due to the limited amount of seats that we have for each room if they have a passport, which is on a first-come, first-served basis, based upon the passport that you obtain.
Okay, so you genuinely think there's going to be a mad crush of people to see Yona Yona Penguin?
Well, I mean, I do think that, you know, actually I've seen it, and I think it's a great film.
I'm not saying it's bad, I'm just saying it's very obscure.
Well, you know, I think people are very curious. I think people would be interested in seeing what it's all about, especially if it's Madhouse's first 3D CGI film. You know, I think it's something to be said that if a studio like Madhouse produces something like this, that it must be of quality because they know that a lot of things that come out of Madhouse is of quality. Mm-hmm. It's not something that they do for just the reason of just doing an animation. They actually put a lot of thought, a lot of process into it. So it usually comes out as a piece of quality. So I think a lot of people would be very interested in seeing, you know, even something as Yona Yona Penguin, which is very, very cute. And I think a lot of people would be interested in seeing what the very first CGI film from a company like Madhouse, what they would be putting out. And so, you know, it's not saying that there'll be a mad rush per se of, you know, 10,000 people. Yeah. That'd be ludicrous and obnoxious for me to even consider that. I think it's more of the fact that we do have limited seating, and those that do want to see it, you know, because we are free, we will definitely have seats open for the public that come that don't purchase a passport. But if there are a limited number of seats, we can't provide it to everybody. So we would rather give it to the individuals that have helped fund our event. So I think that's fair to the public for them to see that.
Right. So the intention then of AM Squared is to promote class warfare. That's what you're saying.
No,
I'm just kidding.
You're just so awful. just no, kidding. I mean, I don't think it's class warfare.
It's just a joke, Chase.
But I think it's funny, actually. I think about it. It's like, yeah, you kind of can see that, but, you know, but it's more of like, let's say as a VIP club, you know, it's like everyone can get something for free, but to be part of an elite group, because we're not in the position of, or even my vision for this with my team was not to create a situation where we would sell 5,000 or 10,000 passports. That's not our intention. We only have a couple thousand that we want to sell. That's
right,
it.
Right. So you, just, you know, yeah, just put up two signs. One sign says halves. The other sign says have nots. And then people will know their place. But seriously though, I'm curious about what your expectations are for numbers. Now, free participants do register on the website, right?
No, not necessarily. Have to register at all. They can just show up. I think at that point, then their only cost is parking. And for us, I can tell you from what we're seeing in our numbers, especially taking into consideration the interests, our current passport sales and all that, we're looking at around, I would say conservatively, about 10 to 13,000 in unique attendees just this first year.
Pretty good for a first year.
I think so. And, you know, we're not here to make money hand over fist. We're not here to charge people for every little thing, you know, to make money or make ends meet. We're here to really try to support the industry, give a safe space for the fans.
Right.
We would rather have, I personally, from the get-go, as I've told you before, I would rather see fans, if they can't afford, you know, a badge or a passport or whatever it is, to take what they can in their income or whatever they're bringing to the convention to spend, take that into the exhibit hall. Support one of the vendors or as many of the vendors as they can to, you know, purchase something from them.
Mm-hmm.
It's important because I don't think people realize that if we don't support the industry will basically crumble even more so than what it is currently. The aim for AM Squared is to help the industry grow in a different way, which is to open it up to those who are on the fence of coming into a convention and being exposed to all the amazing new titles and opportunities that come with the industry itself of titles for hardcore fans, for casual fans, and all of that.
Right, so the idea being that you're removing another barrier of entry into fandom for people.
Correct. You know, it is, and I apologize, I'm using you know so much.
It's okay.
My apologies. But it is to find a way to have a healthy balance. And we are a nonprofit, so we are doing as much as we can to not only help the industry, but also to help the people of Japan, especially with the recent earthquake and tsunami situation. A lot of our efforts, we've already raised about $40,000 that we sent over to Japan with all our partnerships.
That's nice.
And yeah, which is fantastic. And I feel very, very proud of my team and all the people who have supported us with this. But also our charity auction, we're actually going to be donating a portion of that. I don't know if you've heard of it as of yet. A portion of it's going to CHOC, which is Children's Hospital Orange County, out here in Southern California, because we want to also support, you know, a charity that's within the United States, but we're also supporting the Japanese emergency NGOs organizations, which they are very transparent, and all the money that we send there will directly go to the relief efforts of Japan.
Cool. Well, that's very it's a great idea.
Yeah, so I hope, you know, people come out. There'll be donation boxes in our summer festival area for that, as well as for the charity auction. So we're going to have some amazing things at the charity auction, including, you know, Kashiki boards, autographed images from our band members, articles of things that, you know, would normally go for a pretty high sum that we want to give out and have it raise as much money for these two wonderful charities.
Cool. All right. Just out of curiosity, for an event like yours, I know you guys are nonprofit, but what is your single, is there one single biggest expense that an event like yours has to deal with?
The one single, actually, you know, there isn't one single expense. Everything is expensive.
Right.
You know, I mean, the first time I got one of the bills, I almost had a heart attack. I mean, I cannot tell you how I went through some palpitations, and I was like, what? How did some other people handle this in the past? But I was like floored. The facilities itself does cost a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
And because not only are you renting out the facilities, you're also having to pay for their services, for their personnel, cleaning, the insurance, any of the staff that needs to stay on board, like, you know, for air conditioning, lights, security. Then I think the next highest cost would be from the decorators and the audiovisual at that point. But those three would be the biggest cost. And then, of course, and this is purely dependent upon what you have, then your guests of honors are pretty high based upon the expense on for travel and when they're here, their accommodations as well as their meals.
I would imagine the bands probably maybe command an appearance fee, I would imagine.
I can tell you that for AM Squared, none of our bands are doing this for an appearance fee. They're doing this because they believe in what we're doing. They believe that what we're trying to do is create a space where we can create an alternative option for the industry, as well as support, of course, the Japanese industry and the Japanese people right now in their time of need. I think a lot of people think that because, you know, with the whole situation with Katrina, which had like all these fundraisers for like almost a full year, that kept it going, you know, kept that fever going about that whole support situation. And the Japanese situation, which kind of like died out within about 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
Some people have the impression that they don't need the help anymore, but contrary to that fact, they do need the help. There's a video that we will be showing to our attendees that show both what has happened and update them on what's going on, as well as give them some information about what's being done in Japan, and that the country as a whole, the hope that they have to rebuild their communities.
You guys got... I didn't actually see it myself, so I don't think it was up for very long. But you guys got hacked, and somebody put up a message on the site saying that AM Squared was canceled. How long was that up? Did this have any meaningful impact? Do you know who did it?
You know, it's unfortunate that there are individuals that felt that they needed to do something like that to our event. I'm very saddened by that. I believe it was on for a very short period of time, not even within 30 minutes. We had it taken down immediately, but according to our records, it did hit quite a bit of people that got that message. For those that were coming onto our website to check out more information. And it was very, very spiteful, I think, and very, very wrong for them to do. We are getting the authorities involved with this situation. I do personally take it very seriously because there's been so much work that has been put into this. And for whomever it is that felt the need or the desire, we will find them. I do believe that we have located very closely, and we're working with the authorities as well as with internet companies or internet. I'm not very versed about this kind of stuff, but the internet
security people.
Yeah. Well, security people, yeah, to locate the exact address of those that did it. But we are very, very much taking this very seriously. I personally am. There's been so much work put into it, and for them to write something like that and to put additional verbiage on it that was highly inappropriate, whether it was to sabotage or to be a joke or to destroy the event, is just very, very disappointing that people actually go to that extreme. I think we had one hacking a while ago, and we beefed up our security on it, and it had like this awful anti-LGBT comment on it, which I thought was very, very horrific. I have tons of friends who are part of that community, and I do, you know, share their sentiments and will, you know, I'm very supportive of everything in that aspect. But I do feel that this is very serious. And those that did it, I would be very, very scared and be very, very aware that I am personally going to do something about this.
The Chase Wang hammer of vengeance will fall is what you're saying.
Well, no, I think you know, this is very serious.
Oh yeah, yeah. No, I understand.
There's so much money involved. Mm-hmm. There's so many people who were involved. Our exhibitors, our guests, our vendors, the ACC itself. You know, I mean, I can't tell you how many calls I got and so many messages from Facebook and Twitter saying, you know, is it really canceled? Da, 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 da. And I had to personally take time out from what I was doing for the convention to answer all these questions, which I don't mind doing, but it was highly unnecessary and kind of like a nuisance that we shouldn't have had to go through.
Now, I gotta mention this, but the language that you use when you talk about this, is very clearly indicative that you believe it was someone from AAX or working on behalf or with somebody who is partial to AAX at the very least. Because at one point you said you were disappointed that someone felt that AM Squared was such a threat that they had to stoop to doing this. And the only people that obviously might look at AM Squared as a quote unquote threat would be AAX.
You know, honestly, I don't name names. You know, people can say that I could be stating that group. But, you know, I, for myself, am not stating that it's one person. I won't accuse anybody directly until, you know, I have full, firm evidence, you know, about this. We are closing in on the address of the IP. You know, we have that information. We have what city they're in, and we have some additional information. I can't get into it, but it is something that I will be pursuing. And if it turns out to be something of that sort, then, you know, we will have to take additional action. But until then, I cannot confirm nor deny, and I think you can appreciate that.
Yeah.
because I don't want to accuse someone directly if they haven't done it.
Well, the important thing about all of this is that it didn't impact the convention, really. It was just an annoyance for you to deal with, because I'm sure you didn't get a whole bunch of people canceling their registrations or asking for refunds on their passports or whatever.
Well, not necessarily. But, you know, to me, I do feel that it is an anime convention, but there are people, whether they are anti AM Square, pro another event, or vice versa, it could be anybody. You know, when you look at the whole situation, AM Squared is in competition with many different events.
We disagree on this, Jace.
I know you may disagree, but I think if you look at the big scheme of things, we are in competition with other organizations for industry sponsorship, for international attendees, for press attention. For example, you know, even though we're not close to them on dates, we still compete with Otakon. We still compete with Anime Central. We still compete with Fanime. And at this time, in our time frame, it would be ludicrous for me to say that we're not even in competition with AX. We are. You know, we are in competition with them for sponsorship dollars. We are in competition with them for attendees. We are in competition with many different things, but we're also not in competition with them on certain other things as well. But we are also, to say the same thing, we're also in competition with Japan Expo. Because they're having a completely different country. Companies only have a certain amount of resources. Attendees only have a certain amount of resources.
I understand. In the macro sense, yes, you have to compete for guests, you know, yeah, who might not be able to come to your show because they're going to another show.
Of course.
Even like press who can't come to AM Square because they have to go to AX.
Of course.
You know, that's I understand, but I understand that. But this is a unique situation with the date being what it is.
I agree with you on that. I do believe a lot of people would agree with you on that. I think that if anything, if you look at the offerings of AM Squared, you will find that for an event as young as our event, it is pretty amazing to have the lineup that we have, number one, and to be able to operate an event like ours without charging every little thing on our attendees, and that we have a solid, you know, a solid block of programming for all three dates. And we also have all these amazing offerings for our attendees that do purchase passports. For example, all the discounts at all the listed retailers like Macy's and Best Buy, and once again, the theme parks such as Knott's Berry Farm and Disneyland, as well as a whole bunch of restaurants in the area, that we want people to understand that we're here to help our fans to have a good time. And in this economic situation, during these times, we want to make it so that people understand that we're not here to just fill our coffers up so that we can, you know, have all this money and do whatever we want with it. We want to take that money that we make from what we can to apply to the future years, but we also want to provide an opportunity for all our attendees that support us to give them offerings that they may not get from other places that do provide an additional benefit. So, for example, like if someone was to purchase a three-day passport, and just by getting a 20% discount at Best Buy, they could purchase basically, like if they wanted to, a plasma screen TV at a 20% discount, and that 20% discount pays for more than just the passport itself.
Yeah, actually, quick question about that. Is the, so, you know, you buy a passport, you get 40% off Disneyland. Is that only good for, like, the 4th?
No, it's actually, it's good for any of the days that the convention's happening, but more than likely, I would assume most people will want to take part in the convention for the first 3 days, and then on the 4th, I would think that they would pack up at their at the hotels that they're staying at, load up in their vehicles all their items, check out, and then go park at Disneyland and enjoy the rest of the day at Disneyland and then drive out.
Yeah, because people, like, maybe you're set in Orange County, and I would imagine you're going to have a lot of locals who will already know this, but July 4th is a nightmare at Disneyland.
I think it really is. I mean, and I've been to Disneyland on the 4th.
Yeah, wow.
And it's pretty fun. I mean,
it's still fun, but you know what I'm saying, man. The crowds are nuts.
Yeah, it is crowded. Maybe because I was up at that little private restaurant that they have getting, you know, hammered.
Yeah.
You know, it was quite the happiest place on the earth for me.
You're right,
you know,
yeah.
It was like one time I was there at Disneyland with one of at one of my friend's birthday parties. They actually, I don't know how he did it, but he had cornered off half of Disneyland for his birthday. And
yeah, you can rent it out, yeah.
Yeah, he had champagne and alcohol, you know, bubbling everywhere. And that was the happiest place on earth for me at that point in time.
Yeah. Okay, so let's get to Twitter. We got some Twitter questions for you. Manga Man asks, how did you go about forming a new convention team after leaving AX?
How did I come to form it? It wasn't just me. I believe, well, from the get-go, my entire team and I are very, very transparent about many things, and we're very open about a lot of our activities, as well as to my staff and volunteers. We're very open about every single thing that we do, because I think one of the most important things is transparency when you're trying to do something like this. And we actually started off AM Squared after our initial event at Club Nokia last year,
mm-hmm.
which was a very successful event. And when we had fans coming up to us, and I kid you not, I was very, very taken aback by it. I'm very moved by it when I saw some of these fans come up to us and thank us, and they were near tears for us doing something like this that was affordable to them, and that was something that they could enjoy, really moved us. And so we kind of looked at the situation and thought, should we actually even try this? And I thought very long and hard about it, and I didn't know if I wanted to do something like this, because to me, I wanted to just be happy with where I was at and just be happy with doing what I was doing. But after seeing how a lot of my friends and the people I worked with when I was at a different organization, how they were affected by the changes that affected them, and that they were no longer with an organization, very sad, and mm-hmm. that since there was nothing for them to go back to, even after a whole bunch of weird, I don't even know what to say about that, but all the hoopla and all the drama that happened there, they were not welcome back still. And I felt for them. And, you know, before I even came to AX, I worked a lot in entertainment. And, you know, I mean, working in entertainment, you kind of become kind of cold and harsh and bitter. You know, it explains a lot of my personality, right, Zach? So, but when I was working at this other organization, you know, I don't know if I drank into the Kool-Aid or whatever it is, but I became friends with a lot of these people. And I don't have family out here. So they became like my family.
Mm-hmm.
And I really felt for them. And I really felt, you know, this is something, if I can do something for my family, I would do anything for my family. And if they feel, and I had a very long talk with all of them, and I said, if you guys really feel we can do it, I will do my best in bringing the best GOHs I can, bring the best programming I can, but they need to come through on their end with everything else to make it happen, which I think they have. And I think we can be very proud of what we've created. It's like, you know, a lot of people, I've heard jokes and from the other side calling this AM Squared, quote unquote, was it ChaseCon or even was it RevengeCon and all that kind of, it was pretty sad.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt that those that were saying those things didn't quite understand the bond that we all had together. We worked all together to create an amazing product before. And I think with all our experiences and our knowledge and know-how, we can all do the same thing for AM Squared. And when we came together and we finally decided to say, yes, well, let's do it, we did it as a group. And we decided everything as a group. I had open discussions with the entire staff about finances. Even to this day, you know, if anybody wants to know, they can just come to me and I'll share it with them. Granted that they can't take it away with them, but I will share it with them. You know, I will share policies of reasons of why things are done a certain way if people need it. If people have questions, they can ask me directly. I've always been an open book. And I do understand that, you know, some people, even on staff, no matter how friendly you are, sometimes they are afraid to come and talk to you. Mm-hmm. But I try my best. And I know my team also tries their best with their individual teams as well. So in some senses, we are very transparent. And we want our fans and our attendees to know that we are doing this, put on an event as an alternative for the industry to see as a viable source to present their new products, but also a viable event for them to see that this is an affordable event. This is an event that we really truly feel is for the fans, by the fans, and that it is something that we want to provide that is economical and is fun, that our attendees who do purchase passports do get more of a bang for their buck than wherever else they would go to.
Right. Okay. Okay, Alex Leavitt asks, seems like some fans are traveling between AX and AM Squared. Any idea of the actual numbers? I don't think there's any way to find that out, of people going to both, and is going to both good for AM Squared?
Well, you know, honestly, I do feel that there's going to be a large contingency coming back and forth
mm-hmm.
between both events, and that's something I welcome, because I want people to see that there is a difference between the two events, and both events are there for a reason. Both events can survive for their own reasons. We have different offerings that may not be available at the other event. To this date, I could be completely wrong, but I do believe that we are the ones that have an arcade. I don't know if they have one as of yet. We do have a musical guest list that is very, very strong, and all our guests are alive and can sign autographs. And I think, you know, their offering of Miku is fantastic. I feel bad that, you know, not that they've had some issues with their ticketing from what I heard, and I hope that they resolve it as soon as possible. You know, I really do feel bad, because the fans, I mean, you know, if you're going to spend that much money on a badge per se, you know, you do have an expectation to a certain degree. And I'm not saying anything bad about them, don't get me wrong, but, you know, I do feel for them. I do hope that they are able to resolve it to the best of their abilities that's acceptable to their attendees. Once again, I will state that there is definitely competition between the both. It would be stupid for anybody to say that there isn't any competition. There is. But I do feel that we have a very strong offer to our attendees. We do have quite a bit of events, a list of activities that are very, very, very lengthy. And we do have things that aren't found anywhere else. For example, you know, like the screenings of Yoni and a Penguin, of My My Miracle, even the Bunraku film, we have that there. We also have the contest from J-Rock Revolution that we just announced with it. We have our host club, as well as our anime cafe event, which is very, very popular. And they have like a couple of themes, like a schoolgirl theme and some other theme. I don't remember what it is, but
right.
Yeah, there's so many things going on in my head that I can't even remember right now. But, you know, we also have a summer festival, and there's quite a bit of prizing, you know, from plushies to hair clips, anime-themed hair clips, not just like the 99-cent store ones. I'm just making that clear to even, you know, compilation DVDs of anime titles. And we have tons of support, prizing support from our, you know, industry members such as Funimation, Crunchyroll, The Right Stuff, Atlas Games, and more. Even, I believe, Hitoshi from Anime Jungle has provided us with some amazing prizing in Tokyopop as well. So, you know, I really want to thank all of them so much for helping us with this.
So Daryl Surratt asks, wouldn't it be better PR for AM Squared if you released fewer, more impactful press releases? It feels like you issue at least one a day.
Well, you know, possibly, but to me...
You're very aggressive with those press releases.
I know, and I have always been that way, and I do believe that, you know, people can take it for what it is. I do provide press releases because there is so much information that we have that we're putting together that something may apply to someone, whereas something may not. And to me, it's all based upon your perception of what is newsworthy and what isn't. To me, I will put something out that I feel is newsworthy, that is important for certain groups and maybe not be as important for other groups, but to me, it's important for people to know what we're trying to provide. It's not something that we can just kind of like, if you don't put things out there and let people decide for themselves, then what's the point of even having press? Yeah. You know, it's like for a cosplayer, knowing the fact that they could get $100 for wearing, you know, a Gacked outfit to the Bunraku premiere at our event, and, you know, knowing that it could be judged by some pretty famous high-end people that are involved with the film, that it might be more important to them versus that information to, let's say, someone who is not a fan of Gacked, who is not into J-Rock or anything like that. So for me, it's more about me putting it out there for our fans and our attendees to know what it is that they want to know.
Yeah, I think just the issue is after a while, I mean, you are more aggressive than almost anyone else I know in PR. And I think the issue becomes, like, after a while, it kind of turns into white noise, especially for the press, because and we're in a unique situation because we're looking at press releases all day.
Correct.
And it eventually gets to a point where, like, I half expect you to put out a press release like AM Square to feature working restrooms, you know, just everything that you could possibly say about
the
comic.
Well, you know, honestly, that could be a good idea.
Oh, shit. <I'm
kidding>. You know, I mean, to me, you know, I understand where you guys are coming from, but I think when you're doing a convention, if you have something to talk about, put it out there.
Right.
If you don't have anything to talk about, like let's say if I did put out a press release on toiletries at AM Squared,
right.
I personally would laugh at myself and think I'm an idiot. So, but I think it's important to be honest with your fan base and your attendees. If you are going to change policies, you should let them know and not let them find out last minute or at the event itself, because there are a lot of people who don't know certain or policy changes or schedule changes, whatnot, or certain people, you know, they'll be blindsided at the event. For example, like even to this date, I do get questions about, you know, what are we going to be able to get an updated schedule? Are there going to be any maps? And, you know, I have to remind people, you know, even though we put out the press release, we are working with Annie.me to have a free phone application where there will be updated maps and updated daily schedules for them to obtain for free and be able to utilize that for, like, a scavenger hunt with Annie.me, as well as to vote at our AMB event, as well as our film festival event. I think that in itself can show how important it is to get as much information out there in a timely way, because even though you may put it out there, some people may still not get it.
Yeah, yeah. All right, well, wrapping up here, I did have one last thing I sort of wanted to ask you. Mm. So all of this, there's been a lot of storm and drang and drama and a lot of hurt feelings and people upset about having to make the choice. Now that we're only a week away, are you at all regretting the decision to put this thing on the 4th of July weekend in the area? And are you seriously considering moving it for next year? I'm just curious, what is your perspective on this whole thing?
Do I regret it? No, because it was a team decision, one state, that this was not done on purpose to spite anybody. This was based upon the scheduling that was available throughout Southern California. And
I know, and you've said all that, but you've said that before, and I totally understand that.
Right.
But I'm just curious, like, you personally, are you, when you think about next year, I mean, are you seriously considering, like, okay, let's go ahead and put it in June, or let's put it in August, or May, or on a Memorial Day weekend, and it just avoid this whole thing, avoid all of this drama completely. Is that floating around in your head at all?
Honestly, no.
Okay.
I haven't even thought of it.
Foot on the gas pedal.
You know, my thoughts are to get through this year first.
Yeah, yeah. I'm sure.
Before I even consider the following year. And honestly, we do have the dates held. I won't announce the actual dates, but I do have dates held for next year already.
Okay.
So, to me...
I'll find out then.
We'll find out. But I do feel that, you know... To be fair to the attendees, I want them to understand that it's not a hard choice to make. You can compare both offerings and see what's best for you. And all I am asking, my team is asking, is for the chance for them to just try it out. What have you got to lose? 20 minutes of driving down to Anaheim.
Isn't that, that's the ultimate first world problem, isn't it? Oh no, which anime convention do I go to?
I think they just have to compare and see what's more important to them. You know, what activities, what is most important. I know that there's some diehard fans for the other group, and that's perfectly fine. And, you know, I think that they have every right to their opinion. But for us, I do believe that we have a very strong package. We do have something that is very special that we have definitely put our heart and souls into. And we really would love to have the public come and experience this with us, as basically we're kind of giving birth to a new child. And, you know, it's going to take a lot of effort and a lot of work. Of course, you know, we're going to make mistakes along the way. You know, even right now I can admit that, you know, we are kind of like wondering what's going to happen at con.
Right.
You know, we're preparing for the worst, that, you know, either there's tons of people that show up, because I'm getting so much response from people that are telling us that we are going to get slammed because of the offerings that we have. That the other event may not have. And I think that's wonderful on one side, but also something that we want to be prepared for.
Right. Okay, well...
Because you need to have a positive experience.
Well, best of luck to you, and I'm sure that it's going to be a success, and I bet you guys are gonna have a great time. So
thank you so much. Sorry for being long-winded.
No, it's okay. So the convention's AM Squared. It's next weekend, July 1st through the 3rd, at the Anaheim Convention Center. And the website is am2con.org?
Yes.
Yeah.
So they can go ahead and purchase their passports ahead of time. It's a little bit more at con, but we only have a limited supply, so get yours now.
Okay. All right, Jace, thanks a lot for coming on.
Thank you.
Okay, our guest this week is Walter Amos. He's the co-author of the Hetalia History Notes segment on the first Funimation Hetalia DVD. He also runs panels on how history relates to Hetalia, and a longtime fan. Walter, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
No problem. So you are sort of the definition of old school fan. Where did you get started in anime? What were your earliest days like as an anime fan?
Well, I remember I've always liked animation from, you know, as far back as I can remember, and was probably watching Japanese animation on TV when I was a little kid on UHF TV in Philadelphia, where I grew up. You know, things like Speed Racer and Astro Boy and stuff. But probably early on, wasn't cognizant that this was something from Japan. It's a cool cartoon. The first time I became cognizant of the Japanese-ness of it and that there was really something different about it was starting in 1979, Year of Destiny, because I, like, for example, Tim Eldred, who I believe you've interviewed before, and my Italian history co-author Rob Fenlon, are members of what I like to think of as the anime greatest generation, the people who were introduced to anime by Star Blazers on television.
Now, that doesn't make you the greatest. It makes you nice.
Also quite humble, I see.
Yes, well, yes. Humbleness has never been one of my virtues or defects, depending on how you look at it. I was, of course, always a longtime science fiction fan, too. And so here's a show with this awesome science fiction premise. You know, starts out with, unlike your usual show, just before Star Blazers had come on, there was a live-action show I was really into called Space Giants, which I later learned was a live-action, you know, guys in giant monster rubber suits adaptation of a manga by Osamu Tezuka called Ambassador Magma. And that was the typical, okay, we have a giant monster every week, and our hero defeats it, and that's it. And I always thought, you know, why doesn't the bad guy save up his monsters, you know, for a while, rather than sending one all the time? Or send the monsters to someplace other than Tokyo, which has pretty good giant monster defenses. Here comes Star Blazers, where we start out with the very first minute of the very first episode. We're looking at the entire Earth as a devastated radioactive wasteland desert because the alien enemy has actually used a real military strategy. We're just going to drop giant nuclear bombs on the Earth until all the human beings are dead. I said, now that's a military strategy that, you know, a prospective evil overlord can get behind. And, you know, it just sort of got better from there. And the thing that I think got me and a lot of other anime fans out of Star Blazers was the discovery when I first started attending conventions and found, for example, things like Roman albums, which are basically art books of the show, that there was more of this show than we had seen. I could look through some of these art books and go, hey, wait, here's a picture of, you know, the bad guy from the first season, Leader Deslock, sitting with our hero, Derek Wildstar, you know, on, looked like a comfy couch or something. And I said, wait a minute, I got this show pretty well memorized, and I don't remember ever seeing this scene. And I remember distinctly the dealer at one of the creation cons I was at where I saw this and said, oh, yeah, that's from the third season of the TV show. And I was like, wait, what? There's an additional season of the TV show? Oh, yeah, it's really huge in Japan. There's like five movies and this and that and the other. It's like, wow, I have to get hold of this. And this is what I think really got American anime fandom moving, was the idea that there's more of this show out there we want to see, and there's no way for us to get it. It's not on television. We have to go and get it ourselves. And that impetus, I think, is what got people, you know, starting finding pen pals, or my cousin is in the army in Japan, maybe I can get him to send me tapes, and so forth and so on. And it just sort of really spiraled from there.
So did you eventually, as a Star Blazers fan, did you eventually acquire the entire, whatever, everything that was available in Japan for that show?
Eventually, yes. It took a long time.
Right. Were you having people subtitle it? What was the culture? Like swapping tapes?
Oh, no. This was long, long, long before there were such things as subtitles. Yes. I and most of my generation are the crazy bunch of people. We will watch raw, unsubbed anime on multi-generational tapes with crappy color and no sound, and we liked it. We would guess at what is going on, but it doesn't matter. It's a Japanese cartoon, and we have it on a tape, and yeah. Oftentimes in later life, you find out with once people invented fan subtitling that actually the plots we would come up with in our head, we would make up for things, often were better than the actual story of what was really going on.
Well, Yamato doesn't seem like a show that would really suit itself to being watched raw if you had no knowledge, because some stuff, you know, you can kind of see people watching it for the pretty colors or whatever.
Hey, man, I watched Legend of Galactic Heroes raw, okay?
Oh, my God. What is wrong with you?
I win.
Yeah, no shit. Okay. Well, that's the, okay, so as a fan, so you started in Yamato. What was next for you after that? What was the next big thing? Was it Legend of Galactic Heroes? I mean, that was a bit later.
No, that was a long time later. As I said, I started going to conventions when I was in college, and through, I was in the, you know, Philadelphia area, the East Coast. One of these conventions was LunaCon, which is a bit north of the New York area, And it was through that that I first encountered Robert Fenelon, my history co-author, because he was involved with the Star Blazers fan club that was starting up and was also got involved in running the video program at Lunacon and had a separate room just showing Japanese cartoons. And it was through that video room and also the video room at PhilCon, the Philadelphia Science Fiction Convention, that I got to see things like Miyazaki's Loop on the Third, Castle of Cagliostro, and Nausicaa, for example. And, you know, again, these were the days long before fan subtitling. What you would have is somebody like Rob standing in the front of the room, basically narrating. If you were very lucky, you might have somebody who was able to translate a film comic of it out of Japanese with where the dialogue is in the word balloons of the comic. So you could, if you were lucky, you could get somebody who had a something of an accurate script. But, you know, very often it was, like I said, you know, we'll just guess. And here's what I think's going on at this point, and I think that guy likes that girl, and that giant monster is doing this, and whatever. And that was the way it went. But, yeah, this was just amazing stuff. So I started trading tapes. I think the first anime series that I traded, after having been introduced to by Rob and some of the people he was involved with, was Saint Seiya. I think known much more throughout the Spanish-speaking world, because I think it broadcast on TV in Mexico and a number of Latin American countries, is Warriors of the Zodiac, Caballeros del Zodiaco.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was that. But well, it wasn't until years later that that people came up with fan subtitling.
Right, on their Amigas or whatever.
Yeah, I remember the first fan subtitle I ever saw, by that point I had graduated college and moved to Austin, Texas to go to graduate school. And Austin, unbeknownst to me, had a really pretty good and large active anime club, which I joined up. And sometime around 1989 or 1990, the first fan sub I remember ever seeing was a fan sub of Miyazaki's Castle in the Sky, Lapita. And it was, you know, fairly grainy, dark. The subtitles looked like, not like these nice, crisp video things we see now, but almost looked like the white letters from a dot matrix printer, if anybody remembers what those are. So it was a bit hard to read, but nevertheless, I remember distinctly thinking at the time, this may look kind of crappy and so forth, but it has English letters on it that were put there by fans. And I remember distinctly thinking, this is going to change everything. And it did.
Yes, it did. Turned it probably made anime fandom what it is today. So back then, were you actually importing yourself? Were you collecting and importing laser discs or tapes or whatever you could?
I was collecting mainly because not so much because I was an obsessive hoarder and I have to have everything, but because remember back in those days, you know, before the internet, you know, nobody had broadband or anything. If you wanted to get copies of anything, you basically had to mail people, and if they were nice enough to send you a videotape, and many people would only send you a videotape if you had a videotape that they wanted that you could send them.
Right.
So, yeah, I'd like to get your copy of the subtitled Lapida. Well, what do you have? Well, I've got some Saint Seiya tapes. Oh, yeah, okay, send me that. So, but if you didn't have much of anything on tape, you'd have anything to trade. It was really hard to get stuff. So it sort of behooved you to become a hoarder and build up a large tape collection, only so it gave you some leverage to get more stuff from other people.
Right, yeah, Justin can relate to this, yes. Having run Kadocha fan subs back in the day.
And since you mentioned Amiga, I'll put in my one bid for internet subtitling fame is that I did get involved while in Austin with a group of people who did eventually start doing fan subtitling on an Amiga, and we were, as far as I'm aware, the first people who did a video subtitle of Miyazaki's Future Boy Conan series. We formed a group called the Conan Project. Where we
borrowed
laser discs from some people and got translations and did that.
Justin, you remember those tapes?
I do. Well, we had a few of those volumes at Kodocha, and they mostly just sat there.
That was never a very popular show.
Surprisingly, because it's very good.
Yeah. So eventually you got involved in fan subbing, and at what point did you discover, because based on what I'm seeing on your profiles and stuff online, your next great love after Yamato was Legend of the Galactic Heroes. So when did you discover that, and what was that like?
Around 1990-91, in addition to the big anime club at the University of Texas at Austin, there was at that time also a small club, just some people running once a month in a guy's living room, which I also went out to once in a while. And the guy coordinating that had this VHS tape of the first Legend of Gothic Heroes movie, My Conquest is the Sea of Stars, which had been put out a few years earlier, I believe 1988. And like I said, watched that, you know, up there at his place, raw, unsubbed. But, you know, he, knowing my tastes, you know, I'm a fan of, you know, classic science fiction. You know, I'm big into, I tend to favor, you know, the villains. You know, Leader Deslock from Star Blazers is one of my favorites because he just has such awesome style and panache. So, you know, we have, you know, uniform designs that are awesome. I'm a big classical music devotee. Of course, all the background music in Galactic Heroes is classical music. And my entire family is of German descent. So when we put this, that very first movie on, it starts up with this credit slate rolling up, a narration, and much like, you know, the Star Wars opens up with the text going by, there's this text rolling up in this very cursive font. But if you're looking at it, of course, it was a multi-generational copy, so again, hard to read, grainy and whatever. But I said, wait a minute, that cursive font is German. The first line is... Das Krieg dauert noch, you know the war is still going on and so forth. And so immediately my interest was kind of piqued. And then if it goes through that text, it starts up with Admiral Reinhard von Lohengram's space fleet coming toward you, just these phalanx after phalanx of these ships, you know, against this, you know, star background. And I was like, oh, this show is pushing every one of my buttons. You know, I don't care. I don't understand what the hell's going on. I'm just going to look at it and just luxuriate. And then we zoom in on, you know, Reinhard's flagship's command center, and instead of having your typical, you know, buttons and blinking lights, you know, their command center and the Imperial flagships have gilded Doric columns with their command chair in rich Corinthian leather, and he's sitting there in those gorgeous outfits with the metal collars and epaulets. It's like, oh, you know, this show, you know, if you could not possibly design a show better than Galactic Heroes to push, you know, every button that I have. And it's maybe just the weird way my brain is wired, I fully admit to that, but
somehow they had your photo on the wall when they were making that show.
Yeah, perhaps.
Well, that's interesting. So that must... is there any frustration in that for you? Because that show has struggled to gain any kind of notoriety here, and there have been several efforts to try to get it released, some sort of wacky, we get 1,000 fans to pay $1,000, and we can get it out. Have you been part of any of those movements?
When they had that sign-up chain, which you're referring to, that, yeah, if we could get enough people to commit to buying it before, we might be able to do it privately or something. Yeah, I signed up for that, but yeah, that never went anywhere. I've been very grateful to see the Central Anime guys doing the video fan subs, which I think has done more than anything else to get it out there. But you know, a word of credit I think has to go to Sisu Shamba, who did the translations of it back in the day from translating the film novels, you know, in which people did some of the first video subtitles. My friends in the Conan Project, we did use her script to produce a videotape fan sub of the first movie years ago as well. I think her scripts became the basis for the beginning of the Central Anime stuff. But yeah, so it's made it more accessible at least, because yeah, not very many people, I will freely admit, have my intestinal fortitude to sit there and watch a show which is mainly talking heads about politics and strategy without subtitles. but that has helped. But in a way, it's not too surprising to me that it's not that big in the anime community, because most of the anime community, particularly these days, tends to be younger teens. And it is a heady, complicated show. I've maintained for a long time that the natural audience of Galactic Heroes is not to be found among anime fans, but among basically hard science fiction fans. You know, the people who might be going to those literary conventions I mentioned, like PhilCon and Ludicon and so forth. And so I tried for a while to see if it might be possible to pitch it more in that direction.
Did you have any success?
A little bit. I ended up being very lucky in that the World Science Fiction Convention in 2001 was held in my hometown of Philadelphia. And the Philadelphia Science Fiction Society, which hosted it, by that time, one of my former college roommates was involved in running the society. So the little light bulb went on over my head that, oh, hey, this is probably the first and only time that I'm going to have an inside line to members of the con committee of a world con. So I said, yeah, I want to do some panels on this show and push it. And it so happened simultaneously, totally independently, that the producer of Legend of Galactic Heroes anime, Mr. Yukio Kikukawa, and several of the other staff were a part of the bid committee to have the Worldcon in Japan several years later. The way Worldcon works is in a different city every year, and if you want to have it in your town, you have parties at World Cons beforehand and say, have it in our town because we've got this great convention center and all these attractions, so vote for us. And the attendees vote every year for where it will be held a couple years hence. And bids to have it in foreign countries basically always win. But since, you know, as you would expect, the people involved in making Galactic Years in Japan are also big literary sci-fi fans. They came over and they were pushing their Japan 2004 or 2005, I forget what year it was, bid. So it was like, okay, this is all, I could not possibly have planned this any better. I'm going to be doing panels with the blessing of the con committee, and I'm going to have the producer of the anime coming over there of his own free will there. So we did some panels there, and he brought over a subtitled film print from Japan to screen in the film room. But yeah, it didn't really go anywhere either. I think it, also there the problem is in part that, one, the attendance of those old-line literary sci-fi cons are dwindling rapidly. They're not pulling in any new blood, and basically their old attendees are just dying off.
Right.
There are no vampires.
Yeah, and two, there's a very strong anti-media bias among some of those attendees at that convention, because some of the people in the committees running them feel that the purpose of these conventions is books. You know, we don't care about, you know, whether it's video or anime or whatever, so that's media, you know, media should be over there. We're just in serious books over here. So it didn't get pushed either. But, so it goes. At least now I have the whole thing fan sub so I can watch it. And, you know, I do know more people are gradually discovering it online. So that's good enough.
Well, that's cool. Before we get to Hitalia, which is sort of why you're here, you had a really cool opportunity earlier in the year surrounding the live-action Yamato movie. And tell us a little bit about that trip and what you experienced.
You know, as I mentioned, you know, Star Blazers was the thing that hooked me and many of my generation into anime. So the biggest thing to come along in Space Battleship Yamato, which is of course the original Japanese name of the show, in years was the big live action movie released last December in Japan. And Tim Eldred runs the StarBlazers.com website, probably the best Star Blazers Yamato fan site around. He's also, of course, a professional comics artist in his own right. And through several, you know, Yamato mailing lists and so forth that we're both on, he put out the word that, hey, I've done several trips to Japan to gather information on Yamato and stuff. There had been a new animated Yamato film the year before called Yamato Resurrection he had gone over for. And he said, I'm definitely going back to see the live-action premiere. And since I've done it several times, I've got the whole, you know, thing planned out for, you know, where to land, where to stay, how to do it. Anybody who wants to join along on the trip, you know, let me know and we'll make the reservations and coordinate it. And I thought, well, this is just too good of an opportunity to pass up. This looks like an awesome movie from the trailer clips that I had seen. And having somebody who has done the trip before and knows what to do, basically set up the reservations, you know, was too good of an opportunity to pass up. A lot of people I know were a bit surprised that, you know, having been around as long as I am and an anime fan as long as I have been, that I've never actually been to Japan before.
Hmm.
So, you know, Tim set up the reservations, and yeah, it was just absolutely awesome. You know, the movie was great, and a whole bunch of totally unexpected side effects happened, which I could not possibly have planned on beforehand. Which, you know, I joke among my friends that in a way that trip sort of ruined Japan for me, because if I go back, and I probably will go back later this year, I doubt that I will ever be able to do anything as unbelievable as was able to be accomplished in that 1 week that we did last year. Tim, along with Patrick Macias of Otaku USA and various other people, contacts of his in Japan, had arranged to do a whole series of interviews with people who had been creators of Yamato over the years, both in the animation and manga adaptations and so forth. So he had a whole long schedule planned out, because for him this is basically work, doing stuff for StarBlazers.com.
Mm-hmm.
For me it was, you know, just sort of a tag along and enjoy the ride. And he had mentioned that one of the things he had planned to do was an interview with the character designer for the animation, Mr. Leiji Matsumoto, who's also in his own right creator of Space Pirate Captain Harlock and Queen Emeraldus and all kinds of other stuff, who, of course, is one of my, you know, anime idols. So when I learned this, I said, oh, wow, you had arranged this interview to be done in the Keio Plaza Hotel in Shinjuku in a restaurant there, and had it all set up. And I said, oh, could I possibly just tag along and sit in the back and just sort of gaze adoringly while you do your interview? And he's like, nah, I'm afraid it's in this nice restaurant. We have all the reservations made up and all the questions planned out. It would be kind of an imposition to try to squeeze additional person in at the last minute. So I'm like, ah, okay, I understand. You know, business is business. So I'll go off and do some other stuff on my own. So I communicated by email with some old friends of mine, including folks I know from Anime Expo in years past. As a diversion, I should mention my other perhaps fandom activity, which if people know me might know me from, is that I was the masquerade director at Anime Expo for the first few years of its existence. And through that, I got to know some of the folks there. And one of them, lovely girl Hiromi Hasegawa, was one of the translators. She's now living back in Japan and is working in the anime industry. So I emailed her and said, hey, I'm going to be in Tokyo in early December. Is there any chance we might be able to meet up at some point while I'm there? And of course, she was able to do that. And actually, she independently had the idea and said, hey, you know, Mr. Noboru Ishiguro was the animation director on Yamato and also the animation director on Legend of Galactic Heroes and on Macross and any number of other shows that I love. Has been a frequent guest of Anime Expo for many years. So I've gotten to know him a little bit through that. She said, you know, hey, if you're coming to Japan, why don't you ask Mr. Ishiguro if you can visit his studio? And that thought had never occurred to me on my own. So I got in contact with his translator, Takuki Karahashi, who's also an Expo staffer, and we set that up. So I went off independently, just on my own, to visit Mr. Ishiguro's animation studio, Artland, while Tim was doing his set of interviews on his own. So, I mean, just being able to do that was an awesome opportunity, and I was able to drag along another old acquaintance, Ardeth Carlton, who's another old Star Blazers hand who's been living and working in Japan for many years now with Hobby Link. So she tagged along and fortunately helped me navigate the train system and play translator, which I probably would have been a bit lost without otherwise. So we got to sit down with Mr. Ishiguro, got a tour of his studio, and we had just come from seeing the movie and had the art book, which they sell in the theater for the movie, so Mr. Ishiguro asked to look at it. So we actually provided the first information, these two American gaijin explaining the story of the live-action Yamato to the animation director. I mean, I had to sit there and muse, how weird is this? So we had an awesome time. He's a very gracious man. The idea that he just, you know, would be, say, sure, come visit his work studio, you know, kind of on a whim, it just shows you how unassuming and amazing this guy is. But when I got back to my hotel that evening and Tim Eldred had come back, they were in a little bit of a snit because somehow, and I still to this day do not understand how this happened, their interview they had arranged sort of went all pear-shaped. Their translator had went out to get Mr. Matsumoto from the hotel lobby or something and bring him into the restaurant. And, you know, we all pretty much know what Matsumoto looks like, right? He has his little beard and his little skull cap with the skull and crossbones on it and all that. And the gentleman that the translator guy brought in did not look like Matsumoto. But, you know, at first I'm told that, you know, secondhand, I thought, well, maybe he's not in his, you know, stage persona right now. So they start talking to him. It becomes very obvious very quickly that whoever this guy is, I don't know if he was just an imposter or schizo or what, but this guy who they brought in was a fake. So they ditched him and came in. So their interview seemed to disappear. And it was after the fact they discovered that, in fact, Mr. Matsumoto had been there, but in a different restaurant. And had waited for them, you know, 45 minutes or so, and then took off. So it's like, oh my goodness, you know, one of the most leading lights of anime in our view, and we effectively stood him up. So the translator sort of got on the phone and was profusely apologetic and tried to arrange a makeup interview. And but since this makeup interview, you know, had not been planned out and arranged beforehand, I jumped in and said, well, you know, I don't like to play this card, but I know that Mr. Matsumoto is a big fan of space, that you know, he pushes, you know, human activity in space, that he had come to America previously for conventions for the International Space Society and things like that. I said, you know, in my professional life, I did sort of formerly used to work at NASA. I worked on the trajectory server software for update for the shuttle for Mission Control Center. And I said, you know, if you could sort of drop that hint, you know, maybe I could join the updated interview, if it happens, you know, give that a shot. I don't like to toot my own horn like that with somebody like Mr. Matsumoto, but, you know, anything that would get me in this meeting. So the next day, I was off on my own, just wandering around Shinjuku, not having any, being able to eat with any of my friends that day. And I just so happened to be on the grounds of a shrine, the Junisou Kumano Jinja Shrine, when my cell phone rings, and it's Tim, and he says, "You're the first person I'm calling, but I just got off the phone with the translator who did the arrangements, and we're going to take the train out and visit Matsumoto at his home 2 days hence, and it's all arranged, and you're in." So it's like, I get off the phone, and it is now my personal mission that if I'm ever back in Tokyo in that district of Shinjuku, I'm going to that shrine and offering thanks or something. I don't know if I necessarily, whatever gods or whatever there, if I believe in all that, but man, it sure worked. So I said, I went on this trip, not expecting to be able to meet Mr. Matsumoto, and because of this snafu, however it happened, I got to meet one of my all-time anime idols. And then the third unexpected thing that happened, as I mentioned a moment ago, Ardeth Carlton from Hobbylink Japan, who played translator for us, she mentioned that she's taking voice lessons from another well-known anime personality, the singer Miku, formerly known as Mio back in the day, who did the theme songs for a bunch of shows like Heavy Metal Elgin, Area 88, a whole bunch of other, Gundam 0083, various other things. So she said, if you're not busy on Saturday, you can come and meet up with me in we're doing my voice lesson. You can meet Mio. So again, totally unexpected, not planned beforehand, just spur of the moment. So on this one trip in the course of 1 week, I got to hang out with Noboru Ishiguro at his animation studio. I got to meet Leiji Matsumoto at his home and sit on the sofa, which had previously been occupied by the guys from Daft Punk. If you look at their album, which they did the work with Matsumoto, there's them in their robot hats with Matsumoto behind them. And there was that same couch that I was sitting on, and got to meet Mio in a live house for her voice lesson. So I wrote this article on StarBlazers.com, which, it's not what you know, it's who you know, because all that stuff only happened because through sheer dumb luck or some combination of accident, I just happened to know the right people who made the right contacts and made the right suggestions that all this stuff happened, and I'm just so profoundly grateful.
Yeah, well, it sounds like it's kind of a make-a-wish, except without the whole dying of cancer part.
So
you got to skip that part, fortunately. Well, that's really cool. So you liked the movie then? You dug the Yamato movie?
Yeah, I was impressed with it. I think it is a worthy Yamato film. Now, speaking as a Yamato fan, there are things about it which I would do differently, but I can understand maybe perhaps why they did them. But yeah, it is definitely a worthy Yamato film.
I thought, like,
I really look forward to having it somehow in English.
Yeah, I mean, I thought, like, for what it could have been, it was pretty good. Like, it could have been so much worse than that.
Mm. Like I said, my biggest disappointment with it, I don't want to give away spoilers, but, my favorite thing from Star Blazers is Leader Deathlock, the villain, the leader of the Gamelon Empire from the first season of the show, which is the civilization that has been nuclear bombing mankind into extinction, who has this awesome style and panache and the greatest cape in history. And yeah, the way that what they did with Deathlock kind of differently in the show kind of, put me a bit off.
Yeah, well, he's also barely in it, so there you go. So let's.
In fact, when I was meeting with Mr. Matsumoto, we got to. It was also a little bit of a shock after Tim had this whole long interview set up. He had a whole list of questions that he had solicited from people on the internet. Said, I'm going to be interviewing Matsumoto. If you have a question, send it to StarBlazers.com. And he had this huge collection of interviews, questions. Actually, this whole accident worked out better for him because I think he had much more time to do the interview sitting there at his home than he could ever have had sitting in the restaurant if it had worked out in the first place.
Yeah.
But after he got through all his old prepared text, he went around the room to those of us sitting there and said, "Hey, well, okay, now that we're done this, any of y'all have questions?" And I was like a deer in the headlights for a moment. I was like, oh, I have to think of a question. And since I was sitting right next to Tim, I was the first person he turned to. I was like, pass, come back to me while I think a moment. And once I collected my thoughts, I basically asked Matsumoto about the fact that, for me, one of the most profound moments in Star Blazers in the second season is when Deathlock sort of has a moment of Satori and realizes that the human beings he's fighting are more honorable than the sort of the new enemy he had been allied with in the second season, the Comet Empire, and realizes that, you know, these humans, they may be a bit technologically primitive, but fundamentally their hearts are the same as mine. And, you know, I've had this whole thing wrong, that you human beings from Earth are the honorable enemy, and, you know, I should, I'm going to hold true to my principles, support you. And, you know, the redemption of Deslok, I think, was one of the most profound moments in the show for me. And I asked Matsumoto about it, given his views on how in an earlier adaptation of the show in the movie, the Arrivederci motto, Deslok basically commits suicide when he loses his battle against them. And Matsumoto railed against that. He is very opposed to the idea of ever giving up one's life under any circumstances, even if, you know, it's, you know, I can save the world by plowing my ship into the oncoming asteroid. He is totally against that. He said, you know, he lived through the World War II and, you know, the Japanese suicide missions, the kamikaze, and is totally opposed to that. And so I asked him if his influence on the show changed that plot point so that Deslok lives and has that sort of redemption. And he said, in fact, yes, it was. So I was in a way very pleased that I got to ask that question and talk about that bit of influence, which was, for me, very powerful as a kid.
Okay, so somehow you got involved, and we've been sitting here talking about Yamato and Legend of Galactic Heroes. Most people would not make the leap, oh, the next thing this guy's really going to get into is Hetalia. So how did that come about? How did you discover that show?
How I discovered that show, I have sent you a link to a video here that about a year and a half ago, I had not heard anything about Hetalia at this time, although it had already been running for some months, and I think it was already very popular in fandom. But I was sitting in my apartment watching something on YouTube, which I don't even remember what anymore. But you know how on YouTube, if you're watching a video, they have, you know, similar videos on the side?
Mm-hmm.
Whatever, one of the videos on the side happened to catch my eye because the still frame from it had what was very obviously two anime Bishonen characters dressed up in 19th century European regal robes with sort of the ermine-lined capes and medals and sash and so forth, which, you know, again, from Galactic Heroes, that kind of uniform design is like catnip for me. And the title of this video, which I could just see from the text there, was Kaito and Gakpoid 7 Weeks War. Now, I had no idea what a Kaito or a Gakpoid is, and the only thing I know of from about 7 Weeks War, and like I said, from my interest in German history, is this obscure war between Austria and Prussia from 1866. I thought, well, okay, yeah, that's this history thing, but surely they would make some sort of anime video about that. In fact, yes, they did exactly make an anime video about that. And I watched this thing, and I later learned, it turns out that these two Bishonen characters are Austria and Prussia from Hetalia, and they're using Kaito and Gakpoid, or apparently these Vocaloid programs, synthesizer programs you can use to have an artificial voice make music, much like Sharon Apple from Macross, or right, from an earlier day, Eve Tokamatsuri from Megazone 23.
Right.
So fans had programmed these male Vocaloid singers to sing these lyrics, and the lyrics were basically Austria and Prussia rapping at each other about the causes of the 7 Weeks War, including, you know, such things as the question of Greater versus Lesser Germany, which was the question of should we have all the German-speaking people of Europe united in one big country, or have, you know, the Austrian Empire as one thing and northern German states unified together as a separate country. That would be called the Lesser German solution. Otto von Bismarck favored the Lesser German solution, the famous Iron Chancellor of Prussia, because he knew that if we had everything together under Austria, you know, the German Empire would be ruled from Vienna by the Habsburgs. And he said, no. I'm you know, a Prussian patriot first. I want, you know, the German Empire to be ruled from Berlin and dominated by Prussia. So he favored the Lesser German solution. And here's this video explaining this obscure bit of European history. You know, my jaw is hitting the floor as the text subtitles are explaining these bits. And then even better, as I get to this video, my end of the video, my brain is blown. I look at the comments on it, and it's very obvious that many of the comments on this are from high school age kids saying, oh yeah, I watched this video, it was great, and it helped me on my test, and so forth and so on. And I was just blown away. I said, I have to find out what this is. There are people in the comments saying, what show is this based on? And the people saying, oh, it's APH. So I start Googling, what the heck is APH? And it's actually fairly hard to find because you start to get hits like, you know, American Plumbing and Heating or something like that. Eventually, it took me a while to figure out, oh, it's an Axis Powers Hetalia. And then I start reading about what Hetalia is, and I'm just dumbfounded by this show, this concept of, yeah, we have personified countries doing stupid jokes basically about history stuff. And what further sold me on it, and I talk about this in the introduction to the panel, which I do on the subject, I have a friend who's a bit of a comics artist, and on weekends sometimes teaches a how to draw comics, mainly in the manga style class, attended mainly by local teenagers. And he was, came over. This was a Saturday. He'd come over later that afternoon, Saturday afternoon. And when he came in, I said, "Oh, you won't believe this. I found this video. It's about the Seven Weeks War, Austria and Prussia. And it's all watch kids and what?" And he said, "Oh, yeah, that's this show, Axis Powers Italia. All the kids in my class are freaking gaga over this show. They're costuming as it. They're going to conventions. There's a girl who's dressed up as Prussia in my class, and she's totally into Prussia." In a subsequent conversation, not that one, but sometime later, he mentioned an anecdote from his class, which, again, I repeat my panel because it's just so awesome. Somebody else in that class asked this girl, apparently, "Yeah, you're always going on about how great Prussia is. Well, what the heck is so great about Prussia?" Well, first off, most Americans don't even know that Prussia was a thing. If you mention the word Prussia to 99.9% of Americans, they will think you misspelled Russia with a P or something like that. And this girl comes out with, most people, if they do know anything about Prussia, they know, okay, Otto von Bismarck, militarism, right? Einstein, build an empire. This girl comes out, "What's so great about Prussia?" "Well, do you know that Prussia was the first country in Europe to have old age pensions and required a mandatory 4 weeks vacation for its workers and, health care for, Germany under Prussia was the most liberal social state in Europe." And I was just grinning ear to ear when he told me this, because this is, again, an American teenage girl who knows about the social welfare policies of 19th century Prussia. And I have explained many times to people in the course of, debates relevant to our current political situation in healthcare about, why that was. Because Otto von Bismarck was very scared of the Prussian socialists and said, "Well, the people supporting them, the average voters, they don't care about socialist theory or the dictatorship of the proletariat or all that. All they care about is the socialists are the only people saying, hey, you ought to be able to take a vacation once in a while." He says, if I, Otto von Bismarck, give the people that vacation and health care and stuff, it'll cut the legs out from the socialists in the elections in the legislature. And he was exactly right. So, like I said, an American teenager knows this obscure fact about Prussian history and so forth. And so I just had to investigate what this show is and was blown away by it. And the other video I sent to you guys, I sort of make use of you fellas from your podcast from about a year ago, that in fact the thing that interests me about the show is precisely the thing that you guys said in your previous episode couldn't happen, which is that it would get kids interested in learning about world history.
Yeah. Well, I guess we were a little off the mark on that one. So you get into the show, and then I'm presuming you've seen the whole thing and picked up the comics and all of that. When did you decide to start teaching, I guess, based on this show? Because you do a series of panels and also worked with Funimation on a DVD extra on the first DVD, where you do sort of dig into the history that these characters are talking about. Were you just driven by the notion that I now have an audience that actually wants to hear about history?
Basically, yes. When I learned that Funimation was going to be doing the DVD, I was sort of jumping up and down saying, I just really hope they have some kind of notes on whatever they put out that explains some of the surprisingly subtle history references in this show. Yeah, Italia has a lot of stupid in it, make no mistake.
Mm-hmm.
But there are some surprisingly subtle jokes in there, which it takes a serious history professor to get in some cases. I was sort of desperate to get in touch with somebody to say, I do this panel on the history references in there. I'd be happy to, give my information to you guys if you want to somehow put it on your DVD or, but it's not about me. If you don't want to use my stuff, fine. I urge you to contact a history professor or someplace to get some notes. But for the love of God, don't lose the opportunity to put some of the educational material on there, because you've got the chance. Your kids are going to be watching this. And if you can, Italia is the big spoonful of sugar to make the medicine go down, right? Mm. So, let's not lose that opportunity to get some serious information in there. And my big problem is that, I'm in no way an anime professional. I'm just a longstanding fanboy and didn't have any way to get in touch with anybody. until finally, after going through, you know, various old friends who have some sort of anime contacts or who are voice actors, I got in touch with Talisa Jaffe, who I've known from years ago. It was, like I said, since I directed the Masquerade at Anime Expo in its early years, I was emceeing and running the first Masquerade he was ever in at Anime Expo, whatever it was, 92 or 93, where he did a cosplay as Inaba the Time Rabbit from whichever Urusei Yatsura movie that was. And he now, of course, has gone on to become an actual anime professional doing voice acting and directing.
Mm-hmm.
And he put me in touch with the DVD manager at Funimation and just sort of vouched for, yeah, this guy, I've known him for a long time, and he, you know, actually knows what he's talking about stuff. And that's how that ball got rolling. And so basically I just took a lot of the notes that we already had that we were doing for our panel presentations and turned them into text, and they stuck them on the DVD. They were already very far along in the production process on their DVDs. So there was not time to do anything more than just get a few text notes. And even that, they really had to strain to get it in kind of under the wire and get it into the DVD master. So I'm very grateful to Funimation and to Clear and Harp even for just giving us the opportunity to get in what we were able to do. But yeah, so it's that was great. And in fact, as a result of that, I also later got a contact from Tokyopop, which is publishing the Hetalia manga, and had written up a bunch of notes that were going to be included in the third volume of the Hetalia manga they were going to publish. But unfortunately, as I'm sure you're aware, Tokyopop kind of imploded like a flan in the cupboard.
Mm-hmm.
So whether that third manga will ever get published, I don't know. But if it does, hopefully maybe somebody will use the notes that I wrote.
Oh, okay. Well, that's interesting. What kind of response do you get? So you run one of these Italian history panels at a big convention. What is the demographic that shows up? I think I know the answer to that, but I'd like to know what your take is on the makeup of the room, the crowd, and what is their response to your panel?
It's usually very well attended, and I should point out that the next instance of this presentation will be at Anime Expo next week. On, I believe it's Friday, July 1st, I believe at 2:45 p.m. in live programming 2. So
Okay. Anybody
who's going to Anime Expo and is interested, please check it out. Yeah, of course, the demographic is primarily, you know, the Hetalia demographic. As I like to say in the panel, you know, you may notice that I am a, you know, middle-aged heterosexual male, so I'm not exactly the Hetalia target demographic. Yeah, it's mostly teenage girls.
Yeah.
But there are other people, you know, adults and so forth. I have had adults come up to me afterward, you know, thanking me for the information after my last presentation at Anime Next here in New Jersey about 2 weeks ago. A lady came up to me and said she runs several anime clubs through the New Jersey library system where she is, and you know, wanted to have some history information to present to, you know, the Hetalia fans through their group. I have had people who were, you know, independently history buffs and so forth, you know, reading either just on their own or because of Hetalia, come up to me and thank me for the information and discuss some of the points I had made. I have had one or two inquiries from other people who, you know, go to any one of the many, many other conventions which I can't possibly go to and say, yeah, I want to do a panel on the history stuff on it too. Can you give me some information and so forth? So, you know, there are people who have asked serious questions about it. Admittedly, the younger girls, when I show some bits of fan art in the panel, I do focus not just strictly on the anime and the manga, but I also show what I consider to be some better pieces of fan art, which, you know, do history-based themes on it. And a few things, particularly on my personal favorite Enlightenment monarch, Frederick the Great of Prussia. And so some of the fan art I show that has, you know, Frederick the Great and Hetalia Prussia together, you know, of course gets the squee meter going
right
in a few places. But, you know, I'm cool with that. Yeah, okay, it's silly and there's a lot of yaoi potential and whatever. But, you know, like I said, undeniably it's getting some kids who would not have otherwise go off and reading stuff about Frederick the Great. And, you know, generations of history teachers would have given their eye teeth for something like that. I don't care if the underlying reason for getting the information is stupid. The point is you're getting information.
Right. That must be kind of a striking change of scenery for you, too, especially because the normal crowd you run with are sort of the old-timer sci-fi guys who are not enthusiastic, you know, teenage girls or whatever. So that's got to be kind of a jarring shift. But at the same time, it sounds like it's very satisfying just to be able to just to see that they're actually interested.
Yeah, I think it's something, again, about the way my brain is wired, that basically I like to learn new things, and I like it when other people learn new things, when I can introduce people to stuff they didn't know about otherwise and they discover. That artist fellow I mentioned who teaches the class, in another instance, this is for example, I had shown him a PBS Nova program about fractal geometry and how a lot of forms in nature, the shapes of leaves and the bark of trees and the surfaces of mountains can be represented by fractals, which are a sort of a mathematical formalism, since I'm sort of a math science guy. Mm. And this is a guy who's an artist who knows nothing about math and science, but he got very excited about that. He said, "That's awesome." He went out and you know, bought the DVD of that himself and studied and got very interested in fractals as a result of watching the show, not as a mathematician, from the perspective of an artist. And I love doing stuff like that, stuff that hooks up different areas of knowledge. It's art and science, or you know, music and animation, or whatever the heck else, and you know, forming new ideas that weren't there before. And if it's you can get the same thing, you use the silly animation to get people interested in European history, there again, so much the better.
Yeah, it's an interesting analog to anime itself too, because a lot of people get introduced to anime and they also develop an interest in Japanese culture because a deeper understanding of Japanese culture helps them further appreciate the anime. So they learn, cultural tropes and cliches and stuff like that. And they thusly enjoy the shows more because they really understand what's going on. So it's very similar with Hitalia, where if you have a deeper understanding of history, you're going to get more of the jokes. You're going to understand why something is supposed to be funny. It's a very interesting sort of analog there.
Absolutely. And the perspective you have on something can be very strongly influenced by your particular baggage that you bring with you. Having mentioned what you just did, I can't help but flashback to a talk I heard while I was in Texas by Professor Susan Napier, who's written several books on anime and anime fandom, mm-hmm. Who was at that time at UT. She's now moved, I think, to the East Coast. But she was talking about, she had given a series of presentations mainly aimed at adults, sort of explaining Japanese animation to kind of get to, here's this stuff that your kids are watching and kind of what it means. And she had done a showing of the other Ghibli film, Graveyard of the Fireflies, which is a profoundly tragic, sad film about basically the firebombing of Tokyo. And it is impossible to watch that film and just not be bawling your eyes out at the end, no matter how hardened a cynic you are. And she recounted a particularly interesting episode where, of course, the kids all took away from it, how terrible war is and what a tragedy, this and that. But one of these kids' grandparents, an elderly man, came up to her and was a bit angry, she relates, at one of these presentations, because he basically said to her, they bombed us, right? They attacked Pearl Harbor. He viewed it from his perspective of having lived through World War II as that the point of this movie is to sort of indoctrinate people that, the American cause in the war was wrong and the Japanese cause in the war was right or something like that. And it's like, that's sort of not the point at all. But how you perceive something is very strongly colored by your own personal experiences and so forth. And the same is true of Hitalia. These girls are coming to it from the perspective of teenage girls into anime fandom. We're into pretty Bishonen boys and so forth. But again, if we can sort of use that leverage to sort of expand consciousness, explain, if you look at it from this a little bit different perspective over here, you can see these other things that are in there that you might not have seen before and change your perspective. I think that's a good thing.
Yeah, I mean, it has introduced some awkwardness to the fandom in general. For instance, when I see people dressed as cosplaying as World War II era Germany. Not a good idea. Please, kids, don't do that.
particularly, I heard anecdotally that supposedly some people were not only doing that, that going around like in your synagogue and if you're Anime Boston or something, causing problems. So, but maybe because these kids just don't have that perspective. They just don't know the totality of what happened in the war. And I talk about this also a bit in the panel too, that there is some jokes in there. There's a, for example, a very subtle little joke where in Italia, England wants to get revenge on Germany for having, gotten his ass beat. And he was going to summon a demon with magic to go and attack Germany. I guess he watched too much Full Metal Alchemist or something. Mm. And the demon he raises is actually Russia. Comes out, and when he realizes it's Russia, he wants to get rid of him, and he pushes him down. And in the original Japanese, what he says is, "Go away, you damn Kolkhoz." Kolkhoz is a word, which I believe they changed in the English dub. Kolkhoz is a word, it's basically the Soviet state collective farms. And if you know anything about Russian history, you know, Stalin's forced collectivization of the Soviet peasants was, you know, second only to the Holocaust, you know, one of the greatest human disasters of history. Millions of people starved to death, were uprooted, stuck onto cattle car trains, at gunpoint, taken away from their homes. It caused unbelievable starvation, chaos. It was a disaster. And, you know, here's this little joke, which is just like this little funny thing. And if you look at it, oh, it's this cute, funny thing, and not knowing about how really horribly tragic it is, you know, much like you're saying, if you're cosplaying World War II Germany and don't appreciate some of the horrible tragedies that are there, you know, you can get into some real problems, particularly if you encounter people who do know the truth about things and might take offense at it.
Well, I mean, yeah, at the same time, it has inspired a rash of people who think they're doing it specifically because they think they're being shocking and oh so hilariously trolling everybody, and that's kind of annoying, but that's a really minor thing.
There are you know, trolls, idiots, and assholes in every walk of life. And
there you go.
Whether it's Italia or anime or Twitter or whatever, I don't think you're ever going to change that.
Right. Okay. All right. Well, that's all super cool. So your panel, say one more time when your panel is at Anime Expo.
It's Friday, July the 1st. According to the latest information I have, is at 2:45 p.m. in Live Programming Room 2.
Cool. All right. Well, we'll get the word out on that. So before we wrap up here, I got a couple of questions for you from Twitter. Some people sent in some little questions for you. J.R. Neminich asks, how do you introduce new people to Legend of Galactic Heroes?
To be honest, I personally have not introduced new people to Legend of Galactic Heroes in a heck of a long time. You know, the last time I really introduced a lot of new people to Galactic Heroes was, you know, probably the late 90s. I think more people have taken over that mantle from, you know, like I said, the folks at Central Anime doing the fan subs, which is the single biggest thing. The fact that you can just go out there and download it and watch it at your leisure without having to mail boxes of tapes to people, reducing that barrier to entry, is a big help. And I noticed I did attend Otakon last time, and there was a panel with a couple other guys in cosplay, one dressed up as Reinhardt, Admiral Reinhardt von Lohengram, another dressed up as Yang Wenli, introducing the show. And, you know, it's been the last anime cosplay I did, you know, again, 10, 15 years ago, was the dress uniform from Legend of Galactic Heroes. And, the fact that here's other people dressed up in that outfit, there's now, like, a grand total of probably 4 or 5 people in the U.S. who have cosplayed as the Galactic Heroes Admiral costume. But they were doing a splendid job on their own, you know, explaining it to people. And so it's like, well, I don't need to do that anymore. Other people have taken up that torch and run with it.
Yeah, it has kind of become a badge of honor, weirdly, if you can say that you've finished Legend of Galactic Heroes, among you know, the bloggers and journalists and the crowd that I tend to run with.
Well, that's true, but one thing that sort of bugs me about that, you know, that's one of these complaints that I do hear about it. Well, I'd be interested in the show, but oh my god, it's 110 episodes in the main show, and it's so long. How many episodes are there of Dragon Ball Z? How many episodes are there of Naruto? I mean, Galactic Heroes pales in comparison to a lot of these shows, which are unbelievably popular that everybody watches. So, I don't know. It irritates me to have the episode count be counted against it.
Well, it's not so much... I think the context here is that Legend of Galactic Heroes, it's a great show. I did not expect to like it as much as I do. But you have to focus, and you have to pay attention. And it's not fluffy, light entertainment. It's heavy, complex stuff, and it's entertaining, but you have to sit there and pay strict attention to it, not like a Naruto. Yes. It's equivalent to saying, like,
so I'm sure there are no Naruto fans who are going to prepare to write you hateful emails that, no, you must watch Naruto intensely because it's, you know, teenage issues and blah blah blah.
I like to think our audience is a little smarter than that, but yeah, maybe you're right. All right, Netstrike asks, is Hetalia's comedic spin on history kind of what The Daily Show does for news? I don't know that I agree with that.
I don't think it even approaches The Daily Show level.
Yeah.
Probably the better comparison that I believe some people have made has been perhaps maybe to the old Schoolhouse Rock animations. There's a bit of a difference in that Schoolhouse Rock, for one thing, every episode of Schoolhouse Rock, the point of it is to teach you a certain specific lesson. You know, you will learn the preamble to the Constitution, or you will learn you know, the multiplication table for 11 or something like that. Hetalia is, you know, primarily first and foremost a comedy with history jokes in it. So if you care to pursue it, you can try to find out what the heck did that thing he just said mean. But I do want to point out that, you know, as you were referring to earlier, that it's sort of skimming over some of the darker parts of things, that that there's one of the faults that people have laid at the feet of Hetalia is that, yeah, it glosses over the Holocaust and, you know, the pain and the anguish and things of that happened in history, and it turns it into a lot of fluff. I do like to point out that, you know, if you know anything about real history, particularly about the Revolutionary War, a lot of the stuff in Schoolhouse Rock is horrible American propaganda 101 that is, you know, if you were to write down on a college history paper, would get you a failing grade. So, like I said, the main thing is to spark people's interest, not to, you know, no show is ever going to give you enough to pass your history test. But if it just gets you interested enough in whatever subject it is to go off and just do some independent reading on your own for your own enjoyment, that's good enough.
All right, cool. Okay, Paul Freeland asks, how can older fans effectively expose younger ones to the best of the 80s and 90s and not turn them off from older titles?
That's a good question, and it's something that, you know, several of my friends try to deal with. As I mentioned, just having done Anime Next, we do a panel at several local area conventions, and including at those literary conventions like PhilCon that I mentioned, called "These Are a Few of Our Favorite Scenes," sort of an in-joke to the line from The Sound of Music, where basically it's just myself and Rob Fenlon and Brian Price and some other old-school fans showing, it's basically just a clip show of, here's stuff that's cool. You know, not explicitly, you know, we're going to teach you serious stuff, and you kids need to pay attention because this is important. And if you just say, look at this cool thing that you may not have ever heard of, and you get, you know, younger people going, oh, that's pretty awesome. What is that show? I never heard of that show before. What is this giant robo of which you speak? You know, what is this Galactic Heroes and so forth? You know, don't approach things from, you know, this. Sometimes the fans think that, you know, the anime you watch today is fluff, and I'm going to show you the real stuff. So sit down and take your medicine. It's like, no, you're going to turn people off. Just treat it as fun. Say, here's something really cool which you might not have heard of, and you might like, and you know, suck people in. You get more flies with honey than with vinegar, as they say.
Yeah, I mean, you're presenting to them the entertainment fluff from 10 years ago, not yeah, and it's good
stuff.
Just
a superior quality of entertainment.
Yeah, right. also from Paul Freeland, how does one tell the youngins of the joys of Laserdiscs, Synapses, daisy-chained VCRs without sounding old and crotchety?
Without sounding old and crotchety, I don't know.
You can't.
Have I been sounding old and crotchety for most of this interview? I suspect I probably have. If you can basically just, again, try to make it fun, you know, actually, there is one thing I would say to that. When you get onto these, sometimes, you know, at conventions, you'll have the geezer panel where the fans of my generation or older will talk about, you know, exactly this. Oh, we had Laserdiscs, and we didn't have any subtitles, and we liked it, and blah, 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 blah. And people sometimes bemoan the days when, you know, it took work to be an anime fan. You had to have passion and dedication to make the effort to mail those videotapes and keep the massive store of tapes in your closet and do the trading and all that stuff. And, you know, the perspective that I have and that Rob have is, no, it's so much better now. We are now at the position that I sort of hoped we were in for the last 20 years. The idea that you can flip on your computer and pretty much watch a stream at a moment's notice of whatever you want with, you know, people speaking Japanese with English letters on it or dubbed, and you can pick and choose depending on what you like. You know, is awesome. The idea that, you know, we should go back to the days of, you know, this modern medicine with all these drugs and surgery. We should go back to using leeches and no. You know, we are in, you know, the anime utopia that fans have dreamed about for a long time, almost, in a sense. So yeah, there's something to be said about reminiscence, but I in no way want to go back to having to mail videotapes around to get anything done.
Closet full of purple tapes. Yeah, I don't miss those days either. It is fun to reminisce, though, and I think that sort of knowledge, like what we had to do back then, because I became an anime fan about 4 or 5 years before DVD, so I had 4 VCRs in my dorm room or whatever. But it's fun to talk about that stuff with people who are already kind of interested in the history of fandom, and that's the only audience that's really going to care. There's no widespread, like, oh, we need to teach the fans about Laserdiscs and reading a synopsis of a Ranma 1/2 episode. Like, that's just, it's fun. It's fun ephemera for people who just want to learn about the history of fandom.
Again, I think this just recapitulates human nature. You know, it's like the old time World War I pilots. You know, back in our day, we had to pull the propeller and start the biplane and fight the Red Baron. And you got the young Top Gun guy. Yeah, great, Pops. I'm going to go fly my, you know, F-16 or, you know, whatever the heck else. Or the race car drivers talking about, oh, but back in my day when I drove the old Hudson Hornet or whatever, and I've got my new Formula One, whatever. You know, it was ever thus.
Yeah. All right, and lastly from Chuo Dori says, with the first Gundam getting a remake, are there any old school anime that either you or Walter would like to see get a remake? Anything come to mind?
Get a remake? I have on occasion heard people, you know, like to, you know, say that I'd like to see a Yamato remake, you know, an animation Yamato remake of the original series, you know, using, you know, nice slick new computer animation and so forth, because you know as good as I think the story in Yamato is, I think it really holds up story wise and even animation wise in some senses. But you can see dust on the cells, and there are animation mistakes. You know, some kids you show that to, and you know, if they're not in the right mindset, will look at it with the ooh, 70s anime, I don't want to watch that. So some people think if we had new animation, that would be enough to hook them in. Maybe that's true, but you know, that I sort of agree with Roger Ebert on this, is that you shouldn't remake good movies. You should remake bad movies. You know, the perfect example of this was Gladiator. You know, it was basically a remake of this dull, turgid, confusing movie from the 60s or so called the Rise and Fall of the Roman Empire. And they basically just took the good bits out of it, you know, added Russell Crowe and whatever, and made this blockbuster. Says, you know, don't remake it. You know, don't need to remake Citizen Kane. Citizen Kane is perfect as it is. You know, find the new thing, or turn the thing which was a failure before, or find the little gem that's buried in it, you know, and make the good thing. I would probably be more interested in seeing, okay, could somebody take some, you know, stupid anime which most people regarded as a failure in its day and make something great out of it. You know, the perfect example I think of that might be for Giant Robo. Now, I wouldn't say exactly a remake of a failure, but it took a lot of disparate things, a lot of stuff that most Americans had never heard of, a lot of the works of Mitsuteru Yokoyama, you know, put them all in a blender and, you know, added some cool orchestra music and made this, you know, absolutely awesome classic Giant Robo. You know, let's shoot for that. Take something which, you know, most people look down on and say, oh, okay, the real challenge is I'm going to turn this into something awesome.
Yeah, I think the one thing that always pops into my head whenever this comes up is I would really like to see a complete, maybe with an OVA budget, maybe as an OVA, an adaptation of the Nausicaa manga. Because the movie...
I agree 100%.
Yeah, I mean, I love that movie to death. It's my favorite Miyazaki movie. But it's not anywhere near as good as the comics. And, yes, and I would love to see...
My friend Rob points out, his favorite character in the whole history of anime and manga is Princess Kushana from the Nausicaa manga. You know, right. Even much more so than the anime, because she is, you know, much like Reinhard von Lohengrin and so forth, the very epitome of the honorable, noble military leader. You know, much like Frederick the Great in German history, the enlightened despot, who is an archetype that he is very fond of and I am very fond of. And yeah, to be able to see Kushana really shine and you know, the anime missing the whole thing with the Duroc Empire and all that stuff and the religion in there. And yeah, there's a lot of stuff in there.
Yeah, it'd be cool to see. Who knows if they'll ever actually do it. Probably not. All right, man. Well, listen, that wraps it up. That was very enlightening, and it was great fun to talk to you. Thanks so much for coming by.
Thanks so much. And I want to apologize to you two for sort of using you as a juxtaposition sounding board for my explanation of why the Hitalia History panel is actually necessary.
Oh no, we're honored, so it's all good. Okay, everybody, that's our show. Big thanks to Walter and Chase for stopping by. The theme song is Bucharest. The band is The New Division. You can check them out at thenewdivision.net. Don't forget to subscribe to our show on iTunes. Leave us a little rating or a review while you're there, and we'll see you all next time. Thanks for listening.